We're going to begin reading at verse 1. Now when it was reported to Sanballat, Tobiah, Geshem, the Arab, and to the rest of our enemies that I had rebuilt the wall, and that no breach remained in it, although at the time I had not set up the doors and the gates, then Sanballat and Geshem sent a message to me, saying, "Come, let us meet together at Shepharim in the plain of Ono." But they were planning to harm me. So I sent messengers to them, saying, "I am doing a great work, and I cannot come down. Why should the work stop while I leave it and come down to you?" And they sent a message to me four times in this manner. I answered them in the same way. Then Sanballat sent his servant to me in the same manner the fifth time with an open letter in his hand. In it was written, "It is reported among the nations in Geshmu that you and the Jews are planning to rebel. Therefore you are rebuilding the wall, and you to be the king according to these reports. You have also appointed prophets to proclaim in Jerusalem concerning you a king is in Judah. And now it will be reported to the king according to these reports, so come now, let us counsel together." And I sent a message to him saying, "Such things as you are saying have not been done, but you are inventing them in your own mind. For all of them were trying to frighten us, thinking they will become discouraged with the work and it will not be done. But now, O God, strengthen my hands." When I entered the house of Shemaiah, the son of Delilah, son of Methabel, I was confined at home, and he said, "Let us meet together in the house of God within the temple, and let us close the doors of the temple, for they are coming to kill you, and they are coming to kill you at night." But I said, "Should a man like me flee? And could one such as I go into the temple to save his life? I will not go in." And I perceived that surely God had not sent him, but he uttered his prophecy against me because Tobiah and Sanballat had hired him. He was hired for this reason, that I might become frightened and act accordingly in sin, so they might have an evil report in order that they can reproach me. Remember, O my God, Tobiah and Sanballat, according to these works of theirs, and also Nadiah the prophetess, or the prophetess, and the rest of the prophets who are trying to frighten me." As we mentioned before, when it comes to Nehemiah, there are several different ways you can look at this study. You can do it as a study in revival. You can use it as a study for opposition and warfare. You can use it as a study in leadership and all these things, these three themes you find interweaved all the way through the book. Last week we got a really good look at the leadership of Nehemiah. But we have been watching through this book the enemies of Jerusalem trying everything they can to keep these walls from being built. They're trying everything they can, strategies of intimidation, using psychological warfare, trying to wear them down and laugh at them and say, "Listen, even if you did rebuild the wall, it wouldn't be of any use to you and fall down." They use strategies of violence, which would trigger fear in the people that they might not build. They use strategies of discouragement with those who would raise up and say, "This is too hard, we can't do this." And then we saw the opposition from within as Jew would rise up against Jew, and those who had were taking advantage of those who didn't have. And all this opposition was coming against, everything it seemed was coming out against the rebuilding of this wall. And yet in all the opposition that we've witnessed, we've seen the example of this one man who feared God, and he led people in a way which they too would fear the Lord. And each and every situation under his leadership, the walls continued to be built. What an example Nehemiah is, this leader of leaders. Last week we saw this testimony of Nehemiah as authority that is given in the right hands, that authority given in the right hands and God-given authority is never used to live above others, but to live with others. The God-given authority is not saying one thing and doing another, but living out an example before the people in whom you lead. The God-given authority is not used to get others to serve you, but is used for you to serve others. And God-given authority always knows that ultimately it is God who's going to assess the things that you do and the way you govern yourself. This is what we find in Nehemiah. This tremendous example. And so it should not surprise us then as we come to chapter 6 to see what now the strategy of the enemy is as coming against none other than Nehemiah himself. And what we see here is a new operation. It's called Operation Strike the Shepherd. Because if you strike the shepherd, then the sheep may be scattered. If somehow you can get to the leader, if Satan can defeat the Christian leader, then maybe perhaps he can cripple a whole ministry and discredit the whole cause of Christ. It's a strategy that he's been using for a long time. It's a strategy for a leader. And what happens when you become a leader or you've been given any place of authority, is you might as well just face it. What you have done at that particular point is you have put a target on yourself with a big fat bullseye. Where now people are looking at you and examining you and seeing all that you are. And if Satan can ever get a place in there, he can begin to criticize you. Listen, I'm very certain of this. The Bible says that he lives and he is the accuser of the brethren. I am certain that he accuses me before you. I'm certain of it. I'm certain of the things that he does and the strategies that he has when it comes to leadership. And often leaders are blamed for things that they didn't do and criticized for things that they tried to do. And often if you don't like a message, then what you do is you get to the messenger. But in this chapter, we find out that Nehemiah himself, he becomes the target of the enemy. The enemy zeroes in on him. After all, it was because of his leadership and this project that God had raised him up, that no matter what had happened up to this point, the wall has continued to be built. This is exciting. How they must have hated Nehemiah and his enemies. I want us to look here and glean at some of these things that we find here. First of all, in verse number 1, he says, "Now when it was reported to Sanballat, Tobiah, to Geshem, the Arab, and the rest of the enemies, that I had rebuilt the wall and that no breach remained in it, although at the time I had not set up the doors and the gate, then Sanballat and Geshem sent a message to me saying, 'Come, let us meet together at Shepharim in the plain of Ono,' but they were planning to harm me." What you find here is, as the news comes back to Sanballat, to Tobiah and to Geshem, these enemies of these Jews, when they hear the report that Jerusalem and the walls of Jerusalem were just about completed, it was not good news. The news was not good for them. All these piles of rubble that had laid there for 150 years are now at a place where they are once again forming the structure of a wall, and a great wall. And by the way, these walls were designed to keep enemies out. And the walls were up. And who would have ever thought that these feeble Jews could ever accomplish such a task like this? No doubt it was a work of God. Not only when these walls were up, but they were in good shape. It was a building project. It was major success. There was not a breach anywhere, it says. There wasn't a single gap at one place. These walls were firm. They were sturdy. Everything was going, and they were just about at a point to say, "We're finished." Everything was done except for the doors and the gates. And as soon as those things were done, it would be ribbon cutting time. The project is finally finished. The walls are done. We can now be safe. We can now find our security as we can keep out the enemy if we need to. And so needless to say, for the enemies of Jerusalem, this was a bad report. The Jews were successful and they were unsuccessful in trying to stop them. And they were desperate and something had to be done quickly. So comes Operation Strike the Shepherd. If we can just get rid of Nehemiah, then we've solved our problem. Because Nehemiah had been this thorn in their sides and he needed to be removed. And because of him, these people were alive again. Because of him, the people had hope again. Because of him, the people had a future. And so they employ in the section 3 unique strategies of trying to get rid of Nehemiah. First of all, they use compromise. Next, they use slander. The next thing they use is they use spiritual deception. The thing we're going to focus on this morning is this issue of compromise. How the enemy comes with this message. And look at this in verse 2, where they come to him and they say, "Come, let us meet together at Shepharim in the plain of Ono." And he says, "But they were planning to harm me." Now the enemy approaches Nehemiah with this message. And the message is, "Nehemiah, let's get together. Let's be friends." No doubt they were very subtle. I mean, the idea is, let's just all get along at this point. Let's just all be happy. Let's be buds. What you find here is interesting, and you wouldn't know this from the text, but Shepharim is just about exactly halfway between Samaria and Jerusalem. And what you see here is that the enemy is in fact saying, "Nehemiah, why don't you come and meet us halfway? Meet us halfway. No need to be so extreme, Nehemiah. No need to be sold out. After all, can't we just all get along? Can't we just be friends? Let's negotiate. Let's make a deal. Friends. They had another plan in mind. No doubt they could take a just distract Nehemiah from his work and get him outside of the sphere of his purpose and of his safety. Then they would be able to overtake him. In other words, what they were doing is they were setting up Nehemiah for the kill. They were setting him up. One of the things you see here is that distractions are always going to be plenty and it's always going to come. Always these little fires that get in your way, that keep you diverted from being in your purpose that you have before you. But this is much more than distractions being offered. It was compromise. It was friendship with the world. And the world is saying, we're not so bad. Oh, we can just be friends. Can't we just all get along? Nehemiah, don't you understand? We would like you and we want you to be our friend. Just come and just meet us halfway. I want to say this. Beware of friendly enemies. Beware when your enemy becomes your friend. Watch out. When the true enemy gets you on his terms. In the meantime, the enemy would be able to accomplish two great goals. First of all, they'd be able to distract the leader from his work, and then they could set him up for the kill. Now, many great men have been seduced by this enemy of compromise. So let's get along, let's get away, you know, build a relationship, meet us halfway. No need to be so committed, no need to be so focused. I mean, there are many truths, aren't there? So don't be so narrow. Joseph Stowell, who is the president of Moody Bible College, gives this story of this conversation he had with a pastor in the former Soviet Union. This pastor said that Stalin's reign was of the worst time. He said, I had two KGB agents come to me and say, we take care of you, you stay the pastor of that church, but once a week give us a report on every one of these Christians. Work for us. The pastor said, I can't do that to God, and I can't do that to the flock that he's given me. So what they do is they send him to prison in Siberia. And he endured the forced labor and the cold for 10 years. But he did find other Christians in the camp, and God used these believers to fulfill his promise in his life. And what he said was, I was a carpenter building towns for Stalin, said the pastor, and we'd go out 60-mile radiuses, and there would be fellowship together. And today there are hundreds of churches in Siberia as a result of these small prisoner fellowship groups. You see, when men refuse to compromise, they may lose much, but through them, God will fulfill His higher purpose that He has for them. Peace won by compromise is usually short-lived achievement, said Winfield Scott. The story is told all too often of leaders who have been set up for the kill. Everything was going well. There were more and more people coming. There's bigger and bigger projects, and the offerings grow larger and larger. There's greater buildings and programs that come. And then comes the distractions, the ego, the power, the enticement, the things and the pleasures that come along. And when the guard is down and the machine is built, this work that began as a great work for God is reduced to nothing but business. With businessmen making business decisions. And this work that was once so relied upon God has now become a work of the flesh. And what began as something great loses everything that had been set up for the kill. And the message to a lot of church leaders is more is better and bigger is better. And it's the end all. Entertain people. Don't say words like hell or sin. Don't say anything that convicts and sounds negative. Be positive. Think of all the possibilities. Say what people want you to say. Say what people want to hear. Go to church and go to church growth seminars. Learn all the strategies there are to building churches. And be seeker sensitive. Just make sure that you never let any people really grow. The machine is built, and now the machine now you have to maintain the machine, and you keep going on. The machine has to feed itself. Listen, I want to tell you something. That is a strategy for defeat. Strategy for getting wiped out, because the world says to you, let us reason together. We will respect you. Just don't be so extreme. Don't be so sold out and so narrow. And what you end up with is what begins with the spirit ends up in the flesh. Listen, I want to tell you something, family. This happens in your family too. You start off by wanting your whole family to be devoted to Christ. You have this great wedding and you're committed to each other and your family's going good, your job is going well, your income increases, your responsibilities increase, and you work twice as hard, and after a while you forgot what your purpose was. And you don't have the time for the devotions and the fellowship, and you don't have time for church anymore and for your family, and you get this title and you get all this stuff, and all of a sudden one day you wake up and you realize that you have been set up for the kill. While you're winning the battle, you're losing the war. And the wife and the husband or the kids are now getting all the leftovers. This is exactly what happened to King David. It was on the year when all the kings go out to war that David said to himself, I'm going to take this year off. Everyone else, every year he had gone out, he was a victorious soldier, known in his strategies as a warrior, and in that year he decided, no, I'm going to take this year off. And it was this year that he looked over the balcony, he looked and beheld, there was a nice little lady over there by the name of Bathsheba. It was a year of compromise. It was the year of adultery and murder. David was set up for the kill. You can start with such a gust to serve the Lord completely, and suddenly the enemy comes in with an invitation, and his invitation is this: let's be at peace. Let's just get along. Let's negotiate. And before long, what you discover is you are dancing with the world. And this is what Nehemiah was offered, an invitation for friendship with the enemy, compromise. I mean, after all, they were going to be neighbors anyway. Come on down, Nehemiah. Let's have a talk with each other. Meet us halfway. And how enticing this would have seemed to them, because nobody really wants enemies anyway. I mean, who desires conflict? And when friends and the neighbors are there, what good political strategy it is to say, well, sure, let's just all get along. I mean, peace is a good thing. Really, friendship would make things so much easier. Do you know that Jesus, when he was brought into the wilderness, that this is the whole issue that Satan presented to him? Jesus, meet me halfway. It was nothing so extreme as deny God. Just meet me halfway. If you just do this subtle little thing here. But Jesus kept his mind on his purpose and what he was here for. And this is what I love about Nehemiah, because look what Nehemiah does. And by the way, just glean from him here. Look how he responds. He responds with his wisdom because he knew that they weren't out for friendship. In his journal, Nehemiah said this. He said, I knew that they were out to harm me. How did he know that? I think, first of all, he had a good case of spiritual discernment. That is, he had spiritual suspicion. Not everything he knew should be taken at face value. And I think he began to contemplate, even at the thought of them asking him, if I do this, what is it going to cost me? And what is it going to cost the project that we're building? I think of all the things that you and I need in our present day is discernment, because there's so many things that come our way to get in our way and to get us distracted from the purpose that God has for us. The second thing I think that Nehemiah had was he had common sense. I mean, after all, if they weren't his friends before, why in the world would they come and offer him friendship now? Unless they were looking for something from him. If they hated him before the wall was built, why in the world would they want to be his friends now that the wall was built? You see, a leopard will always keep its spots. They had been fighting him all the way. That's why I love that Psalm 1. Blessed is the man who does not walk in the counsel of the wicked, nor stand in the path of sinners, nor sit in the seat of scoffers, but his delight is in the law of the Lord, and on his law he meditates day and night. He will be like a tree firmly planted by streams of water, which yields its fruit in season, and its leaf does not wither, and whatever he does, he prospers. That man who keeps the main thing. In chapter 2, he had answered them these things when they came against him. He said, the God of heaven will give us success. Therefore, we, his servants, will arise and we will build. But you, he said to Sanballat and Geshem and those guys, he said, you will have no portion, right, or memorial in Jerusalem. You have no part of it. Why would the enemy now become the friend? This is the trickery of Satan. To offer constant compromise and negotiation in your life. To offer you to make it easier, to make life so much easier for you, and to convince you that he really doesn't mean to harm you. After all, how much easier it is to go through life if you're not battling. One thing that I have experienced and I've learned the truth is that there will always be those who are friendly to your face, but behind the scenes are plotting for your downfall. There's always going to be those kinds of people who are going to be out there to give you all the flattery in the world and pump you up and tell you how great you are, but in their hearts, they're hoping to see you fall. Pastors, they've learned this, that the same people who desire to carry your bags in when you come into the ministry, into that church, are the same ones who are going to carry them out. You never know. I think of what Jesus said in Matthew 7:21. He said, "Not everyone who says to me, 'Lord, Lord,' will enter the kingdom of heaven, but he who does the will of my Father who is in heaven will enter." Not everyone who claims to be a friend of God is in fact his friend. And Judas would betray Jesus with a kiss. And Nehemiah understood this. They were the enemy. There was nothing that had shown him that they had in fact changed anything. Listen, one of the things that I've learned over the years is I don't expect to get along with the world. We don't see things the same way. We march to the beat of a different drummer, and if all of a sudden I'm finding out that I'm in the flow of the current and I'm going in the current of the world, then I have to examine and say there is something wrong with me. Somewhere I have negotiated. God calls us to faithfulness, not popularity. And the enemy, he longs for us to sacrifice our faith and to sacrifice everything that we hold true and dear to say that Jesus is the only way, and the first objective is for us people is to be faithful to what he's called us to. James would say those stinging words in James chapter 4 and verse 4. He says, "You adulteresses, don't you know that friendship with the world is hostility toward God? Therefore, whoever wishes to be a friend of the world makes himself an enemy of God." The world claims to want our friendship and to want your friendship, and the devil comes to you and he offers friendship and compromise and he says to you, "Let's make a deal." Don't be so radical. Don't preach. Don't be so narrow. Just be politically correct. So many ways to God after all, isn't there? There are many gods. Hey, don't you want to be respected by the world? Don't you want the world to say, "You're not so crazy after all," and to say, "We understand you, and boy, you really are intelligent, not like the rest of those spiritual weirdos who believe that Jesus is the only way." Listen, I want to say this, never at the expense of truth. Why? Because Jesus said, "You shall know the truth, and the truth shall set you free." And as long as the truth remains the truth, that remains potent enough to save, because if I'm going to be friends with the world, we'll never be able to win the world to Jesus and anyone else. I'm talking about things that cannot be compromised, this gospel that builds, this gospel alone that saves. And Paul said, "For I'm not ashamed of the gospel, for it is the power of God for salvation to everyone who believes, to the Jew first and also to the Greek." A.W. Tozer said, "We are not diplomats, but we're prophets. And our message is not a compromise, but an ultimatum. When we tell people about the love of Jesus, that we ourselves live and experience, and we tell them, because the world will never be evangelized by Christians who compromise." Compromise is always wrong when it comes to sacrificing principle. And by adopting the gospel of this age, what happens is the gospel becomes crippled. And compromise is always costly and sometimes fatal. Listen, if people remain the enemy of God, they will remain your enemy as well. Your friends are his friends. Your enemies will be his enemies. Not that we don't love those who are lost and we don't give ourselves, but if we're going to be a testimony to a lost world, we have to maintain the purpose that God has for us in the world. In the world, but not of the world. And Nehemiah knew it. He knew that this was just a distraction from his commitment to finish, and once again, in his wisdom, he overcomes a subtle plot. Look what he says in verse 3. He says, "So I sent messengers to them, saying, I am going to do a great work, and I cannot come down. Why should the work stop while I leave it and come down to you?'" I love Nehemiah's response here. Learn from this, people. He says to them, "I've got too much to do to be distracted by you. I don't have time for this. There's too much to be done. I have greater priorities right now than meeting with you and negotiating with you. There is no time for me to flatter myself with the enemy. In other words, Nehemiah didn't give him the time of day. He said, I just got back to work. And what we glean from Nehemiah is the importance of understanding your priorities. This is the key to the whole thing. He was a man who had focused intent. Nehemiah kept the main thing the main thing. And what Nehemiah did is he understood what he was here for. He was sent by God through King Artaxerxes to accomplish a certain task. And that alone was his business. And fraternizing with the enemy wasn't to be part of it. He had come to build walls, not peace. Isn't that interesting? Isn't that exactly what Jesus said? Jesus said, therefore, everyone who confesses me before men, I will also confess him before my Father who is in heaven. But whoever denies me before men, I will deny him before my Father who is in heaven. Do not think that I came to bring peace on earth. I did not come to bring peace, but a sword. Awesome. For he says, for I come to set a man against his father, and a daughter against her mother, and a daughter-in-law against her mother-in-law, and a man's enemies will be that of his own household. And he who loves his father or mother more than me is not worthy of me. And he who loves son or daughter more than me is not worthy of me. Does that sound like any kind of message of compromise to you? Well, what Nehemiah did was he kept his hand to the plow. Instead of being seduced by this illegitimate friendship, he was all the more resolved to making sure that he completed what he had started. He had his priorities straight. It was first things first. Always. And how I admire him for that. First of all, people, you got to know what your priorities are. The Father's business. But secondly, you have to keep your priorities. And these priorities, and I love what Nehemiah does here and what he has in his priorities, there's something that he had already settled within himself. He knew and he understood what he was here for. And all these distractions and these seductions that come your way in the midst of your moving along with the plan of God, he knew that these were things. They might not all look evil. They may in fact not be evil, but he knew there were things nonetheless to distract him from his priorities. I have to be careful. And the Lord always reminds me of this, of the things that are there to distract me. There's so many things. I have to make sure that things I own don't own me. I love computers and gadgets. I love toys. They fascinate me. I love even politics, believe it or not. Fascinated with it. I watch it. Boggles my mind to see how it works. I look at these situations that aren't my business, and sometimes I'm with other pastors and we're talking about churches and their situations, and I can get all caught up in it, and before you know it, I'm losing the focus of what God has intended me to be. God's intended me to be a pastor. And as long as that's my calling, it should never be any other thing. Why would I ever stoop to being president? If God has called me to this particular purpose. There's this inner message that always comes back to me again and again from the Lord that says, remember the things that I've called you to. Be busy with the things that God has called you to and the people that He's called you to. Keep your focus. Keep your eyes on the important things, because the enemy would love nothing more than to preoccupy our time with unimportant things, things that will never matter, to negotiate. Think of the end of our lives and we're looking at all that we've done and all that we've said. How many things are really going to remain? Oh, I see the pitfalls and what people go through. Paul would put it like this. He said, therefore, if you have been raised up with Christ, keep seeking the things above where Christ is seated at the right hand of God. Set your mind on things above, not on things of the earth. For you have died and your life is now hidden in Christ and God. And when Christ, who is our life, is revealed, then you will also be revealed with Him in glory. I find it so interesting to find the amount of believers who actually believe the lie that somehow you can be so heavenly minded and no earthly good. I have seen many who are so earthly minded they are no heavenly good. But I've never seen a person who has the mind of Christ who wouldn't love if Christ loves. I've never seen somebody who's loved Him too much or been committed to Him too much and sold out too much for Him that they wouldn't serve some valuable purpose here in what they do. Satan is going to work so hard. And I realize that a busy life and the wrong things are no threat to the enemy whatsoever. But a busy life and the right things become the force that he comes to deal with and reckon with. And after a while, you become the target. Why? Because you're focused and you're purposed and you know what your priorities are. Nehemiah knew it from the start. This is something God had given him to do. It was a task of building, rebuilding walls. This was his calling, and nothing was going to stand in the way until the job got done. He was single-minded. Satan worked so hard, people, to neglect the important things. To put the work aside for just a little while to negotiate. And notice in our passage here in verse 4 that the enemy doesn't let up easy. They kept sending messages. Verse 4 says, they sent messages to me 4 times in this manner, and I answered the same way. He said, the message and this offer of compromise kept coming back to me. Boy, isn't that true? It's not a matter of dealing with it once. It's a matter of dealing with it daily. The compromises that come your way. Nehemiah says, in spite of it all, I still answered them the same way every time they came with this message, and yes, there was fear involved with some of the people. Yes, it would have been easier to gain a friendship with them, but he knew that there was something else that they wanted. And I asked myself, what about you? What are the areas in your life that you found agreement with the enemy? Where is it that you've gotten together? What negotiations might you have made, and what priorities have you let go for the sake of expediency? John Fisher, that songwriter, said this. He said, worldly compromise is so hard to find. There's not an issue that you can easily identify, fight, picket, and bomb. It's slippery. It's elusive. It conceals itself on the highest places and wraps its evil tentacles around the most bedrock truth. Disguises itself with much good intention, and when uncovered, it excuses itself repeatedly with helpless cries of fatalism. Compromise is primarily a heart issue, and this is what makes it so hard to find. How do you examine the heart? You see, in truth, as you might say to yourself, well, you feel so much better off, things are going so well. You may even think that you're more happy now that you've come to these compromises and that you and the world are getting along. But I want you to know something. The enemy is setting you up for the kill. And when the enemy comes and he seduces you with other things and other priorities, what he is doing, and he has one purpose and one purpose only, that is to set you up at a place where he can come and get you. I see this happen all the time. I see this happen with people, with young couples, and they come, and boy, before you know it, they're so caught up in this little world over here that they've forgotten the whole purpose of what they've come together for. I see them just getting set up. Strategy, set up for the kill. Take stock of where you are spiritually. What are your priorities? Where are you headed? We are living in a world that has such whacked out priorities. People who are young and strong don't ever think they're going to get old and weak. How many families and churches are going to lie in ashes because of compromise? How many divorces, and how many rebellions of teenagers, and how many, all the things that come because of the compromises in our life, and little things that we say, okay, let's negotiate. A little leaven. Jesus said a little leaven affects the whole lump. You begin with just a little bit, and it works its way in. But what it ends up costing you is everything. Beware when your enemy becomes your friend. Take stock. Remember where your commitment is and where your purpose lies and the vision of what you have for your life. Because God would desire you to be a people of purpose. A people who understand, yeah, I am created by God for God.
of Him. You see, you might think your life is your own, but in Jesus it isn't. It's been bought, it's been purchased. And for you to be effective in the world, you've got to remember that you have one vision and one vision only. Jesus Christ should be prioritized and glorified in you. And when that happens, you watch the potency of the effect that you can have upon the world. You see, either you're going to have an effect upon the world, or the world is going to have an effect upon you. But in order for you to have an effect upon the world, you have to remain focused. And then God uses you to do awesome things. God, keep you from negotiating. Just kidding.